Six music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
I'm not content to be with you in the daytime. Girl, I want to be with you all of the time.
Ray Davies is simply one of the greatest songwriters this country has ever produced. His back catalogue helped define whole eras of British cultural life, and the legendary songs he recorded with the Kinks reflected, celebrated and critiqued the concept of Englishness in a way that no pop band had ever done before. With their second single, 1964's You Really Got Me, the Kinks arguably set the template for British heavy rock for years to come and kicked off an incredible string of releases. The band's infighting caused them to be banned from the US, but that in turn focused Ray on looking at the concept of Britishness, inspiring some of his best work, songs like Days, Waterloo Sunset and Victoria, and early concept albums like The Kinks or the Village Green Preservation Society. He's still writing and performing, recently revisiting his back catalogue for a collaboration album that featured Metallica, Billy Corgan, Frank Black and Bruce Springsteen. I'm pleased to welcome Ray Davies to The First Time. And I started by asking Ray when he was first aware of music as a child.
I grew up in a large family. I had six older sisters and they were a lot older. So they brought, when I was 3 years old, I was exposed to big band music, jazz, Dixieland, blues. And one of my sisters moved to Canada and she sent early rock music before it was on the radio here. She sent, you know, the 78s over. So I was, you know, I was pretty lucky with that, with a big family like that.
So you were tapping into stuff even before it became available in the UK?
Yeah, before it was on the radio, yeah, yeah.
What were the big standout records, can you remember, for you at that age?
Well, you know, she loved Elvis Presley, you know, a lot. But stuff that influenced me, I got got my first influence off TV. TV was a show that played great archive footage, and there was one guy who was on called Big Bill Brunzi. It was an archive, a documentary made in Belgium of him playing in a club. And what amazed me, I was just starting to play the guitar myself, was his dexterity, was his power. He was a big man and had powerful hands. And my dad liked him because he sounded, to quote my dad, like a real man, not like these pop singers, you know, with high voices. And Brunzi was different, to me, different from all the other blues people. He was a singular artist. Apparently he toured the UK and Europe without a work permit. He just flew in, did gigs and got paid and ran off with the cash, whatever. He's a great, great, great artist. And something like Hey Hey by Brunzi would be fantastic because he's got that incredible thumb-picking style.
First record that you went out and you bought with your money, rather than stuff that maybe been brought into the house by your family, what was the first thing that you can remember kind of going out and owning for you?
Well, I was quite shrewd when I started out because we got pocket money, but my brother bought the records and I persuaded him to buy the records to listen to. He loved Johnny and the Hurricanes, people like that, Red River Rock and things like that, but I think the first one I actually got was a record. It was Ray Charles. Ray Charles at the time. I was starting to play in clubs before the Kinks, and we played with a few blues bands. And it's Ray Charles live, and the piano sound on What I Say to me, and the way Ray Charles did his callbacks with the Raylettes, you know. I still do it in my show. I have a callback with the audience, and it's inspired totally by Ray Charles's vocal on What I Say. Oh,
You mentioned bands. What was your very first band like? What kind of songs did you cover? Were you any good early on?
Well, we had a little band, the Kinks. We were like a three-piece, Pete Wave, Dave Davis and myself, my brother and myself. We tried to cover blues songs. One of the songs we really loved that Dave brought was a song by Howlin' Wolf called Smokestack Lightning. There's something incredible about the rhythm of that song and the way the vocal just slots across it. That was the sort of thing we were aspiring to. That and bands like The Ventures, a little known band, was just an instrumental band. But Smokestack Lightning was definitely something we aspired to sound like Alan Wolf.
What about gigs? Did you go to much gigs? Do you remember any sort of concerts that made a really big impression on you, seeing maybe some of these people live?
Yeah, the first gig I ever went to, I was taken to by my sister and her boyfriend. I went to see Duane Eddy and Little Richard play.
That's quite a lineup.
Yeah, and it was a great show. What amazed me about Duane Eddy, he had the original Rebels with him, and they sounded just like the record. It was thrilling to see it and hear it. Fantastic concert, I'll never forget it. And Little Richard was Little Richard, you know. He closed the first half, there was intermission, and there was Duane came on. He looked brilliant and sounded just like the records.
What about the first gig as the Kinks? Can you remember that? Where was it?
First gig as the Kinks was, I think, at Oxford Town Hall. We were supported by a band called the Downliner Sect, and we were just about to release our first record, which was a cover of a Little Richard song called Long Tall Sally. And our fans came up there, and we took all the gear. We had an old Rover sort of car. My brother-in-law was our tour manager, and we had a car called a Rover. And he stuck our equipment and us all got in one car. I don't know how we managed to do that. And I remember it vividly. And it wasn't sold out, obviously, but I think that was the first official Kinks gig.
Because that first single, you know, you said it was covered, didn't quite connect.
You know, I expected it not to connect.
Really?
Because it wasn't the music. We were directed by the record company, who wanted us to cover it. Because the Beatles had covered it in a live concert, and they gave us all these other people's songs to record that sounded like the Mersey beat, and we weren't Mersey. When we played live, we were kind of raw. We had this song, You Really Got Me, that I'd written about 3 years earlier, that we started putting in the show, and that used to stop the show. And so we said, why can't we record that? And the record company were reluctant until they came to see the reaction we got at gigs. And even then, we recorded it once, and it sounded all echoey and like a Phil Spector record. We had a producer from America called Shell. And
Shell Talmy,
really nice bloke, and actually a good producer. And I said, it's not the way we sound live. So it was a big fight about that. And eventually we went in the studio, paid for the recording ourselves, re-recorded it. And that's what ended up to be the famous version of the Kinks, You Really Got Me.
Set me free. side. Girl, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night.
Gone on to be sort of regarded as this kind of one sort of iconic song, but also kind of the birthplace of rock and the birthplace of metal. What's your relationship with a song like now? I mean, do you still enjoy playing it?
I love playing it. Good thing about it, you can play it like a thrash metal song, you can play it like a blues song. I was about 16 when I wrote it. I wrote the instrumental first. I was trying to write a blues song, like something that Big Bill Brunsey could play, do, and a bit jazzy. And it wasn't until we got together and played it, rehearsed it with the band, that we put the backbeat in and the skip beat at the front. Because a lot of people would have recorded it with the first beat on a downbeat, so it would be 1, 2, 3, 4, da, 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 da. It would have sounded weird. But we put a skip beat in. So it wasn't until the band rehearsed it that it became what it was. So it was a really sort of org process of elimination.
First album came out in 1964. Did you enjoy the fame that came with it?
Well, I didn't enjoy. Because I'd written the first two hits on it, we made an album. I didn't enjoy having to write so many songs. We were a cover band, really.
And you didn't enjoy writing?
At first, you know, it was new to me. I thought I'd write one or two songs and that would be it. So it was a bit of a pressure for me to learn how to write songs. I think there are only 6 originals on the first Kinks album. So the second one, I've written them all. So that was what they wanted in those days. I think people still like that.
What was your first trip to the States like?
It was a nightmare, actually. The first trip to America. You asked me about whether I enjoyed fame. I really hated it. I still hate having my picture taken. And I just thought, well, I make music. You know, why can't they just deal with that and let me just get on with my life? I didn't understand why you had to have photo sessions and go on television. The trip to America was fraught. First time we went to America was after a world tour, Australia, Far East. And I'd been bitten by something in Singapore. My leg had blown up to a sort of huge size. And first thing I had to do when I go on television was a big variety show. They said, now when the camera hits you, you've got to dance around. Of course, I had this big sort of club foot. It's like, and I couldn't do anything. So it was a clash of cultures. We didn't have the savvy of people like the Beatles and the Stones. You know, the Beatles and Stones were masters of publicity. They had great publicity machines around them. They were very personable people. Even the Stones had a great way of dealing with the press. The Kinks were complete novices and, you know, roughnecks. And we didn't understand why we had to do all these interviews and things. So we didn't hit it off too well with the American. But the records were big hits. We just didn't understand the publicity part and how to deal with promoters from Las Vegas and people like that. When we toured America, it was mainly pop bands, like Four Seasons, who I didn't really get along with. Won't go into that. And one band on our first tour I really liked was the Hollywood Argyles. They had a big hit called Alley Oop, and it was nice to see people like that. But our first major show that we actually topped the bill was with the Beach Boys, Sonny and Cher, the Righteous Brothers, the Byrds, Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs, all on one show.
Good lineup.
It's a great lineup, and there were we, like, topping the bill, and it was kind of a strange experience. I think the Beach Boys went on after us, actually. But it was great to go to the sound check and hear Mr. Tambourine Man, then go to the show and hear You've Lost That Loving Feeling by the Real People.
Was this about the time that tensions started kind of manifesting themselves on stage to an extent?
Oh, no, by the time we did that tour, the first live tour, the tensions had truly manifested themselves. there were fights on stage, arrests, public pronouncements, and grievous bodily harm, all sorts of things.
Actual grievous bodily harm.
Well, yeah. my drummer felt it necessary to sort of slice my brother's head off of his cymbal. But fortunately, he only got 19 stitches in his skull. Scalp. But it was part of the show, really. So we went to America already sort of in a bit of state of, flux and state of disarray. So it didn't help to be on that high-pressure tour. Consequently, we were banned from America.
For quite a while?
Yeah, 4 years. The prime of our career.
Friends, one of the first songs to be written under the influence of Indian music, ahead of Norwegian Wood, ahead of many, many songs. Do you remember writing it and thinking I'm doing something new and quite special here?
No, I was influenced by these fishermen I saw in Bombay who was chanting, not the song I ended up writing, but they were chanting in their own language just to go to work early in the morning. I had severe jet lag. But I didn't think I was writing anything different. I was learning how to write songs in those days. And See My Friends ended up sounding different because I had a cheap 12-string guitar. It was feeding back. I was sitting next to my amplifier. And the feedback gave it a special quality, so it was a higher pitch.
We have to talk about Waterloo Sunset because it's just one of the most perfect pop songs that's ever been written. I'm sure you talk about it a lot. Can you remember first writing it?
I woke up singing it. I woke up singing the song, and I had Frank Sinatra's voice in my head, and I don't know why.
Has he ever covered it?
No, thank goodness. But it was, originally the song was going to be called Liverpool Sunset. But then I thought, well, I'm not from Liverpool. I want to write something that evokes my feelings, because Waterloo, the place... area has been quite pivotal in my life. As a student, I used to go to Charing Cross, change to go to Croydon, and my first girlfriend, we went to Waterloo. My dad took me there when I was a kid, so it's always been that terminus, and I didn't know what I was writing. I just wanted to write a nice song, and I wrote it on piano, which is unusual for me. And went in to record it. We tried it with a piano player, great player called Nicky Hopkins. Nicky played on a lot of our records at that time. He played on Dedicated Follower Fashion, on the Face to Face albums, Something Else albums. He went on to play with the Stones and the Who. But Nicky's version didn't work out because it's a guitar-driven song. So I went back in the studio, again, without the producer, and just put down that cheap 12-string, using that cheap 12-string that I'd bought for See My Friends. Just strummed it out, metallic sound, put the drums and bass on. Then a week later, we were on the road a lot, put the guitar on. My brother's great guitar part. Very melodic, it's just a minimalist guitar part. Then the next time we could get in the studios, we did the vocal, and it all seemed very easy. And I have great, great memories of recording it, but I had no idea it would have the impact.
Dirty old river, must you keep rolling?
Six Music.
We are the Village Green Preservation Society. God save the old duck, Bonneville and variety. We are the Desperate Dan Appreciation Society. God save strawberry jam and all the different varieties. Serving the old ways from being abused, protecting the new ways for me and for you. What more can we do? We are the Draft Beer Preservation Society. God save Mrs. Moss and good old Mother Riley. We are the Custard Pie Appreciation Consortium. God save the George Cross and all those who are loving them. We are the Sherlock Holmes, English-speaking vernacular. God save the Manchu, the Moriarty Dracula. We are the office block, persecution affinity. God save the little shots, China cups and virginity. We are the skyscraper condemnation affiliates. God save Tudor houses, anti-table pavilions. Serving the old ways from being abused, protecting the new ways for me and for you. What more can we do? Society. God save Donald Duck, Bonneville and variety.
Matt Everett, and welcome back to The First Time here on Six Music, looking at some of the key first moments and songs from a musician's life. And today's subject is Ray Davies. And you've just heard the title track from their 1968 album, The Kinks Are the Village Green Preservation Society. That album saw Ray investigating the concept of Englishness. I asked him if this was prompted by his band's enforced distance from the USA.
Well, the Village Green Preservation Society came about, I think, from being banned. I never thought I'd go back to America again, so I just immersed myself in writing about this fantasy English world. A lot of people love the record, not many people own it. I think people like the idea of the Village Green Preservation Society, but now we're doing it. I do a choral show, we've covered on the choral album, we covered it, and I think that's why it's unique as a record, certainly in our list of albums we had out. It's solitary, it stands alone for what it is, and it, like I said earlier, it's brave, and it's not afraid to fail. I think that's a secret as well.
I met her in a club down in North Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said Lola. L-O-L-A Lola. La 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 Lola. Well, I'm not the world's most physical guy. Why'd you squeeze me tight?
Another song we have to mention is Lola, 1970. Yeah. An enormous hit. What were people's first reactions when they heard it? Because lyrically it's unconventional.
Amazingly, it was banned in Australia. It got to number one in Australia, but it was banned. I don't know how you can do that, be number one and be officially banned. But not because it alluded to a brand name. And
Cherry Cola thing?
Yeah.
Rather than the...
Yeah. When I first recorded it, I said Coca-Cola. And I was on tour in America. I was playing Minneapolis. And the plugger at the record company knows, they said, the BBC aren't going to play it because it's advertising. So I had to fly. I had a day off between Minneapolis and Chicago. And I flew back, changed the word to Cherry Cola, and flew back and finished the tour. But those were the days when those things mattered a lot. Wouldn't be such a problem today, I don't think. But what the Australian audiences missed was the content of the lyric. And maybe they don't have drag queens in Australia.
Oh, they're famous for their drag queens, actually. They love a drag queen, don't they?
Yeah, there's a few of them about, as I discovered. But don't say open doors. I was just finding an interest in subject matter. And also, I wrote the chorus first. I had a one-year-old daughter at the time, something she could sing. La 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 la. You know, I can't even say it. But it was firstly for her. And also, it recounted an experience in a club in Paris a few years earlier, when my manager was dancing with this beautiful woman until 5 in the morning, walked out in the daylight and saw the stubble. You know, so it wasn't a deliberate attempt to make a record about a drag queen. But again, I don't write that way. I just write about things that interest me.
Is that it? Is that the core? Just finding subjects that pique your interest, and from that, that's the songwriting process.
That's the way I generally like to work. Yeah, it's I've got to get fired up about something to write about it, and then it just happens, and it emerges.
Do you enjoy it? Because you said earlier at the start of your career you didn't like the idea of having to write so many songs.
Well, I wanted to be an artist. I just wanted to be in a band. I wanted to be an artist in a painting sense. I wanted to be a painter. I just left art school, and I wanted to make some money to supplement my grant, which was very small. So I worked my way through college. But songwriting, when I wrote a number one, the follow up was a number one, the third single was, well, single after that went to number one. People thought I could do it, and I didn't know. I didn't know how to write songs. So it was a discovery process, and I still don't know how to do it. If you asked me to write a song today, I'd be like a complete novice, and I'd panic for about 2 seconds, and I'd come up with something. I do songwriting courses for the Arts Council, and first thing I say is I can't teach you how to write songs. So I put people in a state of panic first, then they deliver good stuff.
Something's happening, but I'm just gonna turn a blind eye. If I see no evil, I ask no questions and I hear no lies. Can't communicate with minds that are small. With some people it's like talking to the wall, and the fellow who walks away lives to battle another day. And I've really got no appetite for a fight, not tonight. All I want is a quiet life, anything for a quiet life. No ambition to rock the boat when I can just potentially between these walls, I'm on top of it all. I'd rather have them think I'm deaf, dumb and blind than aggravation every time I speak my mind.
How does it feel first going solo out of the stepping out of the
environment? It scared me.
The Kinks environment scared you.
Well, I'd written a book called X-Ray, and I was promoting that and doing book readings, and I thought I'd put some music to it. And a few months later, I ended up playing the Edinburgh Festival for 2 weeks. And after that, I went down to Heathrow, caught a plane with the Kinks. We went to Chicago to play in front of 80,000 people. Cleveland, at the inaugural Rock and Roll Hall of Fame gig. And that was the last gig we played in America. But because X-Ray and what became Storyteller was about the Kinks, I didn't miss them too much. Because I was talking about them on stage. But I do miss being with a unit. And working on this album, seeing my friends with Spoon, for example, and Paloma Faith's band, and Mumford & Sons. I do miss... They're all in... Mumford's particularly are bands, and Spoon are a band. There's something about being in a band of musicians rather than playing with session musicians that is really important. Bands make mistakes, but you make up for the other person's mistake and you cover it up. It's a unique experience, and I miss it a bit, but I've got a great bunch of musicians around me now. Just like to do with growing up together. I was talking to Marcus from Mumford's and said they all went to university and met each other and made the music. It was a common denominator, not a bunch of session musicians who put together like our record company.
Well, thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days, I won't forget a single day, believe me. I'll bless the light, I'll bless the light that shines on you, believe me. And though you're gone, you're with me every single day, believe me. Days I remember all my life, days when you can't see wrong from right. You took my life, but then I knew that very soon you'd leave me. But it's alright, now I'm not frightened of this world beneath me. Spaceships.
Their own space. There's not a slot. Nobody would have said there's a space for Oasis. Oasis invented themselves and forced their way. Same as Blur did to a degree. And you find that, you know, people say, oh, there's Elton John's not going to make it, not going to make an album, so Billy Joel will make it. So there's a slotting process, a programming process. But the great bands forge their own way and make their own destiny.
You mentioned Oasis. There's like almost the sort of template of you and your brother was kind of almost repeated, note for note, blow for blow by the Gallaghers. Did you watch that and kind of think, I've been there? Yep. I know what you're going through.
When I get negative press, when they used to, I understand them. You know, the sibling stuff. And I remember talking to Damon because that was the time when the big war between Oasis and Battle of the Bands and Blur. I just said to him, just think about your music. Don't get involved in that. And he went on, done great things. But I do empathise a bit with siblings in bands, yeah.
Another first, the new album. When did the idea crystallise in your mind that it was going to be possible to bring in this incredibly eclectic list of musicians?
Yeah. Well, it started with Alex Chilton. I don't know if many people know who he is. He was in a band called Big Star. He passed away earlier this year.
Incredibly underrated and incredible band.
Yeah, fantastic band.
Yeah.
And we met in New Orleans. We were just neighbours. We lived near where I was staying. And he said he'd like to do a track with me one day. And he came to London 18 months ago, and we went in the studio. He didn't have a guitar. I played acoustic and he sang. We put a click track down. That was the first track we did for this record. Just two blokes, you know, sitting down playing a song together. And then it blossomed into Metallica.
Yeah, I mean, music knows no stylistic boundaries.
No.
That said, and Lars from Metallica is known for his eclectic music taste.
Yeah.
But I still wouldn't have thought that was going to happen.
No, you see, it was another concert I did last year. This time last year, I played Madison Square Garden for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame anniversary concert, and Metallica asked me to do You Really Got Me and All Day and All the Night, and they were going to back me.
Good backing band.
You know, they were dynamite. And strange thing, that, and again, it's another band, and you couldn't invent Metallica. They had to invent themselves. And it was the most energy I've felt since I played with the Kinks, those songs. And I said, I'm thinking of doing this record, and they said, we'd love to be involved, that's great. And I met Bruce the same night, Springsteen, same night, and said he'd like to be part of it. So it just blossomed into that, really. But like you said, you know, you couldn't have cast it. People sit down. Then you got Spoon, Metallica, Lucinda Williams, Amy McDonald, all these different people. I think it's a lot to do with the diversity of the songs as well. And there's a whole bunch of musicians now saying, why didn't you use me? Or why didn't you work with me? We'll see how it evolves. But I'm really pleased that we got this one done now.
The way you talk about the band aesthetic, is the Kinks door closed for you now, or do you ever sort of look back and, because you sound so passionate when you talk about that band dynamic, would you ever go back? Is the door closed?
You can't go back, but you can go forward. I think it really is, the door's open always. I was speaking to my original drummer yesterday, Mick. Pete, the bass player, passed away. But I don't know, it's one of those things, I never say never, but my brother is reluctant to do it, and I don't know why, but he's got his own issues, so let's leave it at that.
We've had all these firsts, and we're going to finish the show with the last song, which is a song that you can pick. It can be anything you want. It could be a song of yours from the past, present, or it could be something that you've loved, or anything you want. You get to choose the last song for the show.
Well, I did some writing with Paloma Faith after we did our track, and we got a mutual fondness for this song called At Last. I think it's Etta James.
What is it about that track?
I said to Paloma, you know, the important thing is, it's a lot of nothing. She opens up with the title track, but somehow it works. I mean, I'm not saying nothing, using it in a derogatory term. I'm saying what a vocal stylist can do with material. You can turn it into something. It's very simple. And you just add less, and then you just follow it. And some tracks are like that. You know, usually the conventional song, you start with an interesting intro, build a chorus, go back to a verse, chorus, out of there. But this is a performance, and I just was thinking of Paloma this morning about that track she loves. And she's got a great voice, Paloma. I think she's going to do some good stuff. She's just starting out. So that'll be the last one.
It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
How's your son? He made the team this year? He say he wasn't tall enough.
All the glitter
is not gold.
Nah, yeah, we gonna cook this son.
Gold is not reality. Come on. Is what you live.
That's a new girlfriend.
This is family business, and this is for the family that can't be with us. And this is for my cousin locked down, all the answers in us. This is why I spit it in my song, so sweet like a photo where your granny's pitching. Now that you're gone, it hit us super hard on Thanksgiving and Christmas. This can't be right. Yeah, you heard the track I did, man, this can't be life. Somebody please say grace so I can save face and have a reason to cover my face. I even made you a plate, soul food, know how granny do it. Monkey bread on the side, know how the family do it. When I brought her, why the car had to look all through it. As kids, we used to laugh. Who knew that life would move this fast? Who knew I have to look at you through a glass? And look, you tell me you ain't did it, then you ain't did it. And if you did, then that's family business. Everybody standing with us. Come on, let's take a family Grammy picture. Abby, remember when they ain't believing me? Now she like, see, that's my cousin on TV. Now, we getting it and we gon' make it. And they gon' hate it and I'm his favorite. I can't deny it, I'm a straight rider. But when we get together, be electric sliding. Grandma, get them shook up. Oh, nah, don't open the photo book up. I got a Aunt Ruth that can't remember your name. But I bet them Polaroids will send her down memory lane. You know that one aunt. Auntie, you don't mean to be rude, but every holiday nobody eating a food. And you don't wanna stay there, cause them your worst cousins. Got roaches at they crib like them your first cousins. Act like you ain't took a bath with your cousin. Fit three in the bed, if it's six of y'all, I'm talking.
BBC Radio, 6 Music.
This program is a repeat.
BBC
Radio 6
Music.
BBC Radio 6 Music documentaries, telling the stories in music that matter.
It's a station for people that love music.
Updated daily on BBC Sounds. Right now, it's the 6 Music Jukebox.